Torakhti Media.
Hello and welcome to Torakhti Weightlifting Podcast. Serhii Putsov is speaking. Today we have very interesting and big interview with Spencer Arnold. If you don't know who is this, I will tell you now. Spencer Arnold is American Olympic weightlifting coach. In his decade of coaching experience, Spencer has produced many national and international level athletes from Team USA, Canada, Lebanon, Denmark, and New Zealand. His most successful American lifters are Olympians Jordan De La Cruz, Harrison Morris, Kate Wibbert. By the way, this material was recorded at the World Weightlifting Championship in Saudi Arabia. Don't miss the opportunity to visit our website torakhti.com and learn more about our amazing training programs. And now, let's dive into the intro of this interview.
I am the head coach for Power and Grace Performance and the head strength and conditioning coach for Hebron Christian Academy. What that means is, so during the day, I train high school and middle school athletes, so 11 to 18, to compete in a sport, whether that's football or soccer or baseball, or whatever. We utilize the Olympic lifts and high levels of technology there. And then when I'm done with that, I go to my gym, which is Power and Grace Performance, and train elite level weightlifters. So been in weightlifting for, I did my first snatch at 12 years old. So I'm 36 now. Somebody can do that math. I've used weightlifting when I was a kid because that was the only way that I was going to get better at sports. And it turned out I was better at weightlifting than I was at sports. And so I've competed in weightlifting nationally and some international competitions when I was young, and then eventually transitioned to being a coach when, you know, Jordan De La Cruz and Jesse Stimmo and people like that reached out to me. But I've always been in strength and conditioning, always been in weightlifting. I think, you know, it's sort of been my life's passion. All along the way, you know, I started as a 12-year-old boy. You get through high school, you do college, get married, have kids. Weightlifting has kind of always been a part of that. So, yeah, that's kind of who I am. My family understands the life of a weightlifting coach, and so they kind of support all of that. But, that's who I am.
And my first question, what is a coaching job for you?
I started weightlifting because I wanted to be good at a sport. Like, I wanted to be good at football, I wanted to be good at wrestling, I wanted to be good at baseball. Weightlifting for me was always a tool to be used to be good at something else. And so I've always seen it that way. Like, how do I leverage snatch and clean and jerk and squats and pulls to help make these athletes better at something else? And so it's funny that now I find myself like using it as the sport, right? It is a sport all by itself. But that passion didn't go away. And so as I started to grow and develop and get, you know, go through education and all of that, I wanted to be able to do both. I wanted to be able to train really elite weightlifters who clearly they were better at weightlifting than they were at anything else. And then I also wanted to train a football player to use the Olympic lifts that I knew were great help and great resources to be the best football player. So how that worked is I ended up getting a degree in education so that I could work in a school environment. And so I run a system that I have three assistants underneath me, and we run every high school athlete in our school. So if you are sixth grade, so 11, 12 years old, all the way to 18, if you are an athlete in our school, you play a sport, you have to take weightlifting as a class, as part of your class schedule. So math, science, social studies, weightlifting, it's required. And so that means that somewhere between 500 and 600 athletes come through my high school weight room in a day, and I expose them to the Olympic lifts and then have them utilize the Olympic lifts to get better at their sport. For a lot of reasons, that's very cool for me to get to take all of this at the world championships level and all this and get to use it at a level where 600 people are snatching and clean and jerking in a day at this school. And that's very cool to me. So strength conditioning for me is the application of the principles to help them become something that they're trying to be really good at, right? A lot of our athletes have gone on to play college and professional sports because we've utilized the Olympic lifts in their training. And so that's one edge. And the other edge obviously is like every now and then somebody walks in and you go, you're special, right? Like you think you're going to be a basketball player, but you're not a basketball player, right? You think you're going to be a gymnast, but you're not a gymnast. Like you're a weightlifter. And you take that person and you start to kind of help them understand and see how they were made for this. And those people become, you know, Pan Am champions and world champions and maybe Olympic champions. And so both of those things are things that I'm very passionate about. I don't think that I should take a very tall male athlete who could be very good at basketball and try to make him a weightlifter. It doesn't make sense. But I can use the Olympic lifts to help be really good at basketball. But on the same side, if the right athlete walks in, is very good at the snatch and the clean and jerk, and isn't really set up to be good at another sport, especially in America, that is, I will help them understand that weightlifting is an option for them. And we've seen many people become world team members through that kind of philosophy.
A lot of coaches from other sports say ollie lifts and strength training are useless and dangerous.
No, I talk about this all the time. You can't be an elite level weightlifting coach and an elite level strength and conditioning coach and not get that question. Right, anywhere I go, they tell me, I get that question all the time. And nobody ever tells me, hey, what you're doing is dangerous, because I think my credentials, when you coach Olympians, coaching a high school kid feels okay. And so I think broadly the question is, are the Olympic lifts good for a high school and middle school athletes for their sport? The answer is obviously yes. Like that is not a question. You can't really, nobody's saying that they aren't. They're saying that coaching them and teaching them and potentially doing them poorly could cause a problem, which I agree with also, right? If I'm a baseball player and I'm gonna throw a 90 mile an hour fastball and I snatch poorly and it could injure my shoulder, that's dumb. You shouldn't do that. But if you teach him, this baseball player who's gonna throw 90 miles an hour, you teach him to snatch at 11, when he's throwing 90 miles an hour, he's got 5 or 6 years of snatching already under his experience. And so he's not gonna snatch poorly. And so part of it is like, I feel specifically equipped to use the Olympic lifts for sports because of my background. I would tell a coach who doesn't have that background, who doesn't feel specifically equipped to do it, to not use them. It's, you can't deny that the Olympic lifts teach coordination and balance and power and strength and all of these things together, right? And eccentric bracing and all of the force development. You can't deny that that's true. That's easily seen in every study out there in the world. What you can say is they're dangerous if they're not taught properly or utilized properly inside of a system. That is true. So my job is to make sure they're taught properly and utilized properly and dosed properly inside of a system that is helping an athlete become a better athlete. If you can't do that, you shouldn't use them. What I wish strength coaches would say is, hey, I don't know how to coach them, therefore they're dangerous in my system. That's true. If you don't know how to coach the Olympic lifts and you try to use them, they could be dangerous. But that's different than saying all of them are dangerous. Those are two different things. Coaches who are willing to say, hey, this isn't my specialty, I'm not very good at coaching it, so I'm not gonna use it because it could be dangerous, I have a lot of respect for that coach. That's a big difference in saying that coach is bad because he teaches the Olympic lifts. Well, that's different, right? Maybe you are bad and therefore you can't teach the Olympic lifts and you shouldn't. There's 1,000 other ways or things you could do.
What is Olympic weightlifting programming for you?
When I started coaching weightlifting, I didn't approach it with the same mindset that I approached strength and conditioning. I just sort of started coaching it, I don't know, by feel. But I would approach training a baseball player or a football player I was very meticulous, I was very careful, because in those scenarios, you're preparing them for something else, right? Weightlifting is just an accessory to help them be better at something else. So I wanted to make sure that I didn't do too much so that they didn't get to their practice or their game and be sore or tired. And so I was tracking all the data and all of the, I know all of the metrics, the tonnage and intensity and relative intensity and volume and, you know, peak into all those things. I was tracking all those things for strength and conditioning athletes, but not for weightlifters. And then I started to see that my weightlifters weren't getting as good as some of my strength and conditioning athletes. And that's when I realized that maybe I should take the same approach, just to track basic metrics to see if what you did works, and if it does, can you repeat it? And so as my program started to grow, especially when Jordan showed up, I realized very quickly, like, you can't guess with a talent like Jordan De La Cruz. You just can't guess. Like, you have to be able to be sure that it works. And so with Jordan, she sort of forced my hand. She forced me to start to care. Because, like, I'm a nerd. I like the data. I'm obsessive compulsive. I care about the little bitty tiny finer points. And so for Jordan, I started to create a system that I thought, man, what metrics can I track every single day and look at every single day so that I can make sure she's getting exactly the stimulus I want her to get? And then if it works, repeat it. And so that's where the whole system got developed on, hey, how many reps did Jordan do today? Well, you have no idea, so you should probably count that. Hey, what was her average weight lifted today? Well, you have no idea, so you should probably figure that out. The whole system got to a point where I was like, man, what things could I pay attention to and then undulate or change on purpose to see if it causes an adaptation? I was just guessing before. The whole system began because I wanted to stop guessing. And then it wasn't till 3 or 4 years later that I realized that that wasn't normal. Like, I thought I was behind the times, that what I was doing was everybody else was already doing. And I found out many years later that this system that we had created with where we track and look at how we can undulate volume and undulate intensity accordingly, like according to the stimulus, wasn't as normal, especially in America. And so for me, it's about being able to track every viable metric I can on an athlete over the course of a cycle to find out if it works. So for Jordan, because she's been with me so long, now I have almost a decade of data that I can look back on and say, well, remember when we did this, it didn't work. When we did 330 average reps in a week, or 330 total reps in a week, and it didn't work, but 310 did. So let's find the sweet spot somewhere in there and begin to push her so that we can build her work capacity. It's like finding those little metrics so that when you make changes, you're making organized changes that are built on science, that are built on objective data, not just you guessing. And that way, if something goes poorly, which it will, it has to, this is a sport, you can point back to say, what things did I change that didn't make a positive change? It just allows me to see change, positive or negative, and identify what caused it so that I can either repeat it or never do it again, you know? And so for me, that the being able to track all of the little metrics, I don't track everything. There's probably some stuff out there that I should or shouldn't, I don't know, should track. But I care a lot about how many reps they do in a week and in a day. I care a lot about what's their average intensity over the course of a week or day or a cycle. I care a whole lot about, are they touching heavy weights? What's their peak intensity each week? Or are they not touching heavy weights on purpose, right? And I care a whole lot about the breakdown of their lifts. What's our exercise selection bias towards? Are we doing more pulling versus squatting? Are we doing more snatching versus jerking? Being able to track all of that lets me set a goal for the beginning of the cycle and then see if each of those specific stimuli help us achieve our goal or don't help us achieve our goal. And so for me, if you open up a spreadsheet for us and look at our program, every athlete in my program can see all of that data. Most of them don't care. But every now and then, like Jordan cares. And so they can see all of it, we track all of it. And then every mesocycle, we make minor changes. Every macro cycle, we may make a big change or a small change.
When do you start to calculate training load from 50, 60, or 70%?
It's a good question. It's a funny story there. I've always believed that 70% and up matters. I don't know why I believe that. I don't have an answer for that. I've just thought 70% seems like where it starts to get heavy or starts to get challenging. I know that technical change can happen at 70%. And then I talked to Mike Gattone, and he was like, no, 60%. He's like, Spencer, you can't tell me if you do 5 sets of 10 at 60%, it's not gonna have an impact. I was like, well, you're probably right. And then you talk to Piros, and Dimas was like, nothing below 80% matters, nothing, always above 80%. And so then I was like trying to figure out my system, and I'm saying 70. Mike Gattone, who I respect a ton, is saying 60. Piros, who's Piros Dimas, is saying 80%, so I didn't know which one. So I decided I'd just track all three. And so for us, we track every rep from 60% up, 70% up, and 80% up. And then at different times in the cycle, we care about those numbers more. So at early in the cycle, I'm gonna care about 60% because we're gonna do a lot of base prep work where we spend a lot of time between 60 and 70%. But as I get near competition prep, what matters most? Well, everything above 80% really does matter the most. We're gonna pay attention to that intensity more. Now, we track all three all the time to get rid of variability, right? We're tracking all three. But what we pay attention to shifts and changes as the focus of each block changes. So as we shift from one focus to another, from preparation to competition phase, to all, you know, to specific to competition phase, what we look at changes. And I think all three of us are right. I think all three matter. I just think when you look at them matters.
Do you inform your athletes about the training program at the beginning of the training cycle?
You know, ultimately they come in and do what you tell them. And then I want them to be able to tell me what they're feeling. And then I ultimately want them to be able to collaborate with me to create the system together. So they know every mesocycle goal way in advance because we talk about it before the cycle starts. We talk about each mesocycle goal. We also create macrocycle goals together. I give them a bunch of questions they have to answer for me at the end. So every world team member, every person competes here at the World Championships will have a follow-up conversation with me about things that they really liked and things they thought went poorly, what are their goals for the next competition, and then we will together create the cycle. I think the collaborative nature allows them to be a little more bought in, like they care about it more. And obviously that information is invaluable for me to know what they really believe works, whether it's true or not. What they think works, to some degree, you have to listen.
How do you see the connection between strength, technique, and mental preparation?
Strength is a really broad term, right? So I would just say general physical preparation is one angle for me. So it's not just strength. It's can you balance on one foot? Can you run in a straight line? Can you jump high? Can you squat heavy? Can you pull heavy? Like those are all fit into one category for me. Like the characteristics of the athlete is one space. And that's just physical characteristics that you're trying to develop to create a good athlete. And that, because here's the thing, if it's just strength, what happens if you get an athlete who's already strong? You don't have to worry about that anymore? No, you definitely have to worry about it. Maybe they're very strong and can't jump. Or maybe they have this big force output, but no power. Or maybe they can't brace. Or maybe their eccentric impulse is bad. Like the whole general physical development of the athlete is one level for me. And that goes down to how do we program squats to also how do we look at their data on the force plates? You know, all of that is one look. The second, if we're gonna do the second part of that triangle is technical. But also we have a technical model that we look at and look at an athlete, but also no athlete lifts the same. So it's, for me, it's like I just told you, like we're gonna teach them the lifts so that they ask questions. Was that right? Was that right? Was that right? But ultimately, we want them to be able to say, move from asking questions to telling me, oh, I felt that and it was right, or that felt that and it was wrong. Or I'm eventually going to flip, right? They ask me a question and I tell them the answer. Ultimately, on the technical side, I want them, instead of asking me a question, I want to ask them a question about the lift and they tell me the answer, right? Hey, why did you miss that? Or why did you jump forward? And they know the answer. And then ultimately, the third step of that technical model for us is, hey, we're gonna work together to say, hey, what did you feel there? And they're gonna tell me what they're feeling as much as, instead of telling me what's wrong, like Jordan can tell me, hey, I'm feeling this in my feet. Or Kate can tell me like, I'm trying to feel this pressure diff change as the bar passes the knee. So it's more so they're, now we're working together to talk about how they feel. And so that's the technical model for us. I think it depends on where the athlete is in the phase of learning and where they are in their career. And also what they look like and their physiology and their biometrics and anthropomorphology, all the stuff that like makes up who they are as an athlete from a weightlifter standpoint. So one is like develop them as an athlete. One is develop them as a weightlifter. And that mental piece, I think we do a really good job of that. it's a big focus for me. So all of our top level athletes meet with a sports psychologist weekly, do visualization work. Also, when they come to our system, we put them through an emotional intelligence survey so I can understand who they are. I need to know if I tell an athlete, you're gonna miss that, how they're gonna respond. Some of them, like Kate, will say, no, I'm not, and prove me wrong. Someone else may say, you're right, and miss it. And so understanding who they are emotionally and how they respond to stress and how they respond to competition and pressure, That mental toughness piece for us is solved in two ways. Like, we're intentional about the sports psychology piece, but we're also intentional about surrounding them with a community of people that are always supporting them, right? We have a really great team who are constantly finding ways to support each other and care about each other. I think putting them in a safe environment where it's safe to struggle lets them struggle the right ways, right? And so we create all three of those pieces of the triangle. And people always say, well, which one matters most? I think it depends on the athlete, right? Some athletes have got two of those eds really easy and one's really hard, so that's the one that matters the most. And so it just, again, depends on which athlete and who you're looking at and where they are. And that may change, right? Jordan is a different athlete this quad than she was last quad. Cade is a very different athlete this quad versus last quad. So that may shift and change. But for us, it's about looking at those three edges and deciding where we need to work and which ones are our biggest frontiers for growth.
I'm curious, why can't you, as a coach, replace a sports psychologist?
For one, I'm not a sports psychologist. I'm not trained in sports psychology. I talk to a sports psychologist every week personally because I need the help. So I'm certainly not qualified to be their sports psychologist. And there are people out there who are, this is their whole life's work. And I don't know the techniques. I'm not up on the research. I don't understand what visualization methods work best. But I can tell you this, when they started working with them, they got more consistent in training. They got more mentally tough in hard sessions. They were able to approach competition with a better mindset. I didn't do any of that. I gave them the environment to develop those traits, and then they talked to a professional, right? I would never do brain surgery because I'm not a brain surgeon. I would never work on your teeth because I'm not a dentist. Why do we think we're gonna work on the mental preparation side if you're not qualified and educated to do the mental preparation piece? That doesn't make any sense. You can try, you're probably gonna fail. And it's going to be that your athlete that is hurt in the process, not you. So why would I just not connect them to somebody who it's their job and they're very good? They're not going to try and coach them. They're not going to try and tell them to fix their snatch, but they are going to help them understand how to better approach the snatch. And so I'm always going to refer to a professional. The way you build great weightlifters is build a really great team of people that surround the weightlifter. All these people on the same page that trust each other, that's how you do. That's how you build a great weightlifter.
What is the velocity-based training idea and tool for you and your team?
Velocity-based training is a element of our training. It's just one of the tools we use when teaching and coaching weightlifting. How we use it, the reason we use it is because it does what I said earlier. It's objective. It doesn't lie, right? It doesn't tell me something that isn't true. I can always trust it, the data that comes from it, to be accurate. My job as a coach is to decide whether the athlete needs to see that data or not, whether the athlete even needs to know it's all, like, we use a camera system called Perch that sits above their rack. So they may not even know it's on. They don't even, like, I can turn it on and look at the tablet and they don't even know it's working. So the implementation of velocity-based training for me is about collecting objective, hard facts that then I can decide what to do with. My job as a coach is to decide, do I want the athletes to see it or not? Do I want them to, you know, because from a sports science standpoint, that verifiable fact, I just looked at read a study this morning, that you get almost 40% more increase in stimulus when the athlete is getting immediate feedback. So rep to rep immediate feedback. Well, velocity-based training tells you, hey, that was 0.45 meters per second. And they immediately know, man, okay, maybe if I try a little harder, I can get 0.46. And so it helps drive intention. And so for me, if I have an athlete, it's everybody who's done weightlifting knows this. You do your snatch balances, and then you do your back squats, and then you do your snatches. And what's the last thing on the program? Well, whatever it is, maybe it's squats or maybe it's pulls. At that point in the day, what are you trying to do? Just like get through it and get out of there, right? Like you're just trying to be done at that point. Well, that exercise is gonna take. Like you're not going to get as much from that exercise, whatever it is, because it's the last thing. Well, how do you make an athlete care about that exercise? I do this all the time. If we have snatch pulls at the end, I'll set the velocity up and tell them, hey, your goal is 1.7 meters per second peak velocity, go. And Kate is a great example. She would have just done them. It probably would have been like 1.5, Like she would have just done them because there's no reason or goal to chase. Well, if I set 1.7 and she pulls 1.6 on perch, like the camera, the screen turns red. So she gets this like sound and it turns red. And so what does Kate, who is a competitor, what does she do? Well, she doesn't like not winning and she doesn't like not achieving the goal. So then she pulls a little harder. And now I saw this, now we got 1.9 meters per second. Well, then I go in and do what? I change the goal to 1.9. So now she's chasing a goal on every exercise. So it drives intention, it drives power, which we care a lot about in this sport. It makes them think about moving the bar fast, not just moving it. And then velocity for me helps me see where the athlete is that day. So if I have five sets of three for Jordan at 130 in the back squat, and she comes in and her set at 120 is like 0.35 meters per second, I'm gonna stop her and have her do sets at 120 instead of 130. Why? Because the goal for me is an absolute strength workout, which means she lives somewhere between 0.5 and 0.3. Well, she's already there at 120. Are you gonna chase 130 for no reason, or are you gonna chase the stimulus? And so velocity lets me chase like an actual goal, like a stimulus goal, rather than weights that don't mean anything. And so for me, I don't see it as a trend. I don't see it as a toy. I see it as another way for me to measure objective data, one of many ways. And then me as a strength coach can decide, hey, this athlete, we're gonna use it this way today. Or this athlete, we're not gonna use it at all. It's just another opportunity to leverage a training technique to get a stimulus, get an adaptation you're looking for. And whether you use it or don't use it is up to you. But you can't say it's not useful. It is useful. It's just about how it's applied, when it's applied, and with what athletes at what time. There's so many things, right? You can use it for set. You can take weights away. Like my high school athletes, we have a perch camera, so a velocity system in every single rack, right? Which means they don't chase weights. They chase colors. Like I set it so that if they're above 0.5 meters per second in a squat, it turns yellow. And if it's below 0.5 and above 0.3, it turns blue. And if it's below 0.3, it turns red. And so my athletes know they come in, you have five sets of three in the blue today. Well, how much weight is that, coach? I don't know. Put some weights on the bar and let's see where you are. And when they get in the blue, five sets of three at that weight. Because with high school kids and middle school kids, you never know, were they up studying for a test? And so they come in on 2 hours of sleep, but you programmed 85%. Well, that's 100% today and you're about to hurt them. And so for me, it allows me to regulate. It allows me to give kids goals to chase, athletes goals to chase that are real-time goals. And ultimately, it allows me to collect as much data as possible to find out, is this athlete power deficient or force deficient? And how do I apply exercises and exercise routines to help force the deficiency? We don't use it for the Olympic lifts. I don't use it for snatch or for clean or for jerk at all. Here's why. I used to try, but then I found that an athlete could actually move a bar faster doing it poorly. So I've seen an athlete do a snatch at 1.9 meters per second and make it, and then get behind the bar early, hit their hips against the bar, swing the bar way out in front of them, and it actually moves at like 2.1 meters per second, but it's really bad technique. And so for me, I don't use it because I think a lot of times the speed lies about the quality of the rep in the Olympic lifts, but in the pools, I'll use it, right? In the squats, I'll use it because I'll stand next to them and I'll give them a technical cue. Hey, push down harder when it gets to the knee. Make sure you keep your back, your shoulders in front of the bar at this point. Hey, make sure the knees squeeze back, whatever it is, right? And then they'll use the camera or the tablet in front of them to chase a specific goal. So it drives intention with a technical focus, right? Like I'm giving them a technical cue to focus on, but it also, instead of just doing the lift right, they're doing the lift right with speed. And that's ultimately what we want, is those two to work together. The camera system that I'm using, though, is starting to develop a bar track where I can set it, if it moves forward 5 centimeters, it'll turn red. And so we're starting to get now where even the camera is gonna start to be able to tell them if it was off technically or not. I mean, we're probably a long way away from that, but ultimately, I want to drive intention, and that intention is being intentional about what we're doing technically and intentional about what we're doing from a force output standpoint. Both of those have to be done with like an intentional goal, and that goal needs to be known to the athlete and something they're chasing, whether that's, hey, Kate, I need the bar to continue to come back past the knee. Or, hey, Kate, I need that bar to move at 1.7 meters per second. Both of those have to be intentional, and the athlete has to know what they are.
Tell us more about differences between men and women training.
Males and females, I think there's three things that you have to consider when coaching the male or a female. One, you just have to understand their temperament. Some females like to work, and some females like to touch heavy weights, and that's true for males and females. And understanding what keeps them motivated, I think that can be different regardless of their gender, right? So Kate, being able to touch something heavy and like feel strong in that way keeps her motivated. Jordan, being able to dig in and do a bunch of work on a technical piece keeps her motivated. That is true for guys too. There are guys that love the work. You got 10 sets of five today, they love it and they want to eat it up. And then you have someone like Harrison Morris from last quad who, if I didn't let him touch something heavy, he would get bored and I would lose him. So I think in many ways, those ways are similar. But I have seen, and many of the studies have backed this up, women, because of their body composition and where the percentage of their strength lies, are able to handle a little more volume. And so because of that, you can't train a male athlete the same way you train a female athlete from a volume and a work capacity standpoint. Just because of how women tend to develop lower body strength at a greater proportion to upper body strength for their bodies, they tend to be able to create greater work capacities and sustainability with volume. Part of that has to do with men, especially where I'm from, they early ages want to develop upper bodies because they look good in the mirror, right? And so part of it has to do with that. The other part is just physiologically, girls develop differently than guys. And so I've always said that I can give girls a little more volume than guys. And if you try to treat a male like a female from a volume standpoint, you have a higher risk of creating injury in the male than you do in the female. But it also is weight class dependent too. So small females tend to be able to handle the most amount of volume as long as they're not having a big weight cut, you know? When you get a small female that has a consistent body weight, you can generally give them the most volume of anybody I've worked with. As they get heavier, you tend to have to be careful on the volume because why? Well, the weights get heavier and that volume takes a bigger toll on the skeletal system and the muscular system. The same thing is true for men, right? You can give a smaller male more volume than you can a bigger male, but that smaller male and that smaller female can't do the same. And so I've always had to, the way we do that, there's no perfect way to figure out which athlete starts where from a volume standpoint and an intensity standpoint. So I've just always started lower than I thought. And then that's the point of tracking data, right? Hey, how many reps did you give them last cycle? And what was their average intensity? Okay, well, they handled that fine. They weren't sore. They didn't get injured. Let's bring them both up a little bit. And then you just slowly inch them up. And in doing that over the history with women, I've just seen that they can handle immensely more than men can. And for many of them, it's a point of pride that they can handle so much and get better. Now, as they age, that changes. But again, how are you gonna know what to change if you haven't tracked them for the last 10 years to see, hey, at 18, they handled this many reps. Now that many reps is causing more fatigue than it used to, so maybe they're aging, so we should bring that down a little bit. I think the data would tell you that, not just the data, but the research would tell you that women can handle more volume than men. But in my opinion, if you don't have a way of tracking the volume, you don't know if you're giving them too much or too little anyways. And so it doesn't matter. This whole argument, this whole debate doesn't matter if you don't have a way of calculating it and deciding, are you giving them too much or too little? The first step before you ever worry about differentiating between male and female is creating a system that allows you to look at them as two separate athletes and look at their data as two separate things. With Harrison, it took me a full year because I had no real high-level experience coaching that good of a male athlete. I mean, that dude was powerful, super powerful, high, just incredibly explosive, and just a high level of type 2 fibers. So he fatigued really quickly. But it took me a year to figure out how to, I remember, I remember I was at a competition. I'd had him, he's been training in my gym for 3 weeks. And I got a call from Jordan saying, hey, are you sure that you're doing this right with Harrison? He's not okay. Like, he had been spit out by a 155 kilo clean. The guy clean and jerked 200. And he got spit out the back by 155. He was really sore. He wasn't recovering. Nothing was working. And it's because, like, I looked at Harrison, A, that he had the background of building work capacity that many of my athletes had, and B, that he was female. Well, he was neither of those things. He did not have the background of building work capacity the way I did, and he wasn't female. So I had to immediately kind of backtrack and restart with him. And it took a full year to figure out what was the best way to train him. And again, he was very smart, collaborated with me well. And that's when I began to really see the differences, especially at the elite level, of how women and men respond to stimulus differently and really recover from stimulus differently. We figured it out. He had a great performance at the Olympics, but that was a nice eye-opening experience for me. And the research just tells you, hey, women can handle more volume than men. Hey, men tend to handle intensity different than women. But they don't tell you anything more than that. They just tell you to handle it differently. They don't tell you how much or how little. They don't tell you what ways to apply it. You just have to figure that out as you go with that knowledge in the back of your mind. And so for me, once we knew a good starting point for Harrison, then it was about like chipping away in the right ways that allowed him to perform the way he did. But it wasn't because I coached him like a female. It's because I coached him like a male, and our females respond to stimulus differently because they're made differently. Like, their body composition is different. You have to account for the menstrual cycle. You have to account for all of these things with women that you don't have to count with males. With males, you have to worry about their body breaking, right? Like, an 81 kilo female and an 81 kilo male, the load on their joints is different, because an 81 kilo female is going to clean 140 or 150 or 155. Where an 81 kilo male is going to snatch that. And so the load on their joints and their musculature is different. And so if you don't take that into account, you could get an athlete hurt real fast and real bad. And so understanding the differences in men and women, I think, is critical to being able to develop women properly. Women handle a lot, and I think a lot of people don't give women credit for that they can handle a level of training that men can't. Because of how they're built and because of the load they're enduring. Like, I think they can handle more than most people give them credit for. And I can prove that by looking at some of the athletes, how they've responded to what many people would say is like, that's kind of an incredible amount of volume. Well, they're incredible athletes and they handled it pretty well and came out better having done it.
Tell us about training of Jordan De La Cruz and Kate Wibbert.
Will always be their coach. I think for me, the relationship of being their coach is the most important one. It allows them to respect what I'm writing. It creates a level of trust. So for both of those athletes, the foundation of our relationship is I'm a coach, they're an athlete, and we grow together in those roles. What I mean by grow together is we become friends through the process. We become colleagues in many ways as they learn about the sport and learn about my philosophy. We become, in many ways, co-coaches, because they're helping me understand what they're feeling. But they're both very different. I've always said Jordan is very precise. She's like a perfectly constructed cup of coffee with latte art that's like perfectly put together. Like, everything is very precise, and that's what makes her so great. It's like all the small details never go unnoticed for her. And so for me, working together with her in that regard helps us both care about the little things. For Kate, it's sort of like if you had an energy drink and you shotgun the energy drink. She's much more like that. Like, she's ready, fire, go. Let's go right now. She's much more reactionary. And so for her and I have to slow her down sometimes and ask her questions. But understanding them both, who they are, and then me adapting to their personalities, I think builds a level of trust that is required. You can't get to this level and be successful with athletes like that without having a mutual trust for each other. I think we both believe in each other. At this point, Jordan and I believe in each other. Kate and I believe in each other. We trust each other. And it's not me sending them out there to be good or to fail. And it's not them going out there by themselves to either be good or fail. Like, it is us together. We're a team. And whether we fail or we don't, it's always a team, right? Successes are joined and failures are joined. We do those together. And I think them knowing that I've got their back no matter what is really important. But at the same time, like how you support them emotionally looks very different. Both of them need different kind of emotional support, whether that's more friend or maybe that's more coach sometimes. You got to push them harder. Maybe that's putting your foot down and being forceful with them in certain things, or maybe that's backing up a little bit and letting them figure it out and you're just sort of making sure that they're okay. I think understanding the dynamics of their personalities is my job as a coach. It's my job as a coach to adapt who I am from a personality standpoint to match what they need in those moments. And then ultimately for us to see each other as a team that works together for a common goal. I don't want them to ever feel like they're alone. I want them to always feel like they got somebody in the corner, whether that's me as their coach, me as their friend, me as their colleague. They've always got somebody in the corner so that when they walk to the stage to take that lift, they know they're walking with support. They're not going by themselves. Like they have a whole gym and a coach who's done this whole thing with them.
What is your coaching dream?
I think I'm living it. I don't know that I have. I don't know. My coaching dream is for athletes to walk out there having already, just to be a good representation of who they are. I don't know that I have a dream other than what I'm doing right now. Like this is it. You have two girls. You have many world team members who came to you, whether that was last year or 10 years ago, and said, "Hey, I want to go to the World Championship or I want to go to the Olympics," and we got to do that together. That for me, that there's no. The dream is to see women and men achieve the goals and the dreams that they tasked you with. That I don't know. There's any other better dream than that. I get just as excited. I get just excited for a girl that said, "Hey, I want to clean and jerk 100 kilos," and then they do it. You know, it's like whether that's fifth place at a competition or it qualifies them for the World Championships. Like, there's no greater dream than to have an athlete come to you with their dreams, trust you with their dreams, and to achieve them together. And that's true for this sport. That's true for everything in life. When you're a coach, the dream is that your dream is their dreams. So whatever their dreams are, when they're achieving them, your dreams are accomplished. I'm living my dream because I'm watching them do theirs.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Tarakhti Weightlifting Podcast. Remember, all your training programs are on tarakhti.com. My name is Sergey Putsov. Stay strong and warm body, cold mind. Tarakhti Media.